So for me, like, I think the most interesting thing was, like, when Sundar Pichai came on stage and he talked about, like, the moving from mobile first to AI first.
Yeah.
And, like, that's where, like, Google kind of is going.
Hmm.
And it seems like Amazon already is moving in that direction. Like, that's what they realized, that they tried the Fire Phone. And they were like, okay, this is not going to stick. So they put all their eggs in this basket and they're putting Alexa in everything. Apple's also trying to do the same thing with Siri a little bit, but it's not as significant a portion of their product line as it is for, let's say, Google or Amazon or even Microsoft to that extent, because Microsoft's got, like, Cortana. That's what I was, like, really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be, it's not just personal assistance. Like, to an extent, it's a lot more. It's it really is, like, how do you consumerify AI and bring it to the consumer? And there's going to be different business models. Google's obviously going to try and do it the same way they've done with everything. Not monetize it directly, but monetize it through, like, advertisements or something like that, which poses a challenge for everyone else, which is like, oh, now we can't make money off it. Apple's going to try and do the same thing through hardware. Amazon's going to try and do it through, like, retail. But yeah, those are, like, my rough initial thoughts.
Okay. So, stepping back, you'd started the idea of this conversation to begin with the discussion of the different waves.
Yeah.
So talk me through the different waves that you're thinking, like, historically, then where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was just generally thinking that computing or, electronics in general has gone through a bunch of waves. If you look at consumer electronics, then consumer electronics has kind of gone through, like, 50s, 60s, you got a toaster. Like, you know, that was, like, the big thing. But even a toaster in that sense was possible because somebody put some sort of thermostat in there. It wasn't really, let's say, like a smart thing, but, like, for that time, it was a huge leap. But, hey, my toaster knows when to shut off. Like, you know, my radiator knows when to shut off so that things are not on fire. Right, it's something as simple as that. But anyhow, I think looking at it not from a consumer electronics perspective or consumer devices perspective, but more from computing is a more interesting way to look at it, because we had, like, the electronics wave, which really started in like 50s, 60s, 70s, and then towards, like, late 70s, early 80s, we started seeing the PC revolution. And that's when, like, Apple kind of, you know, shook IBM, saying that, hey, what you're trying to do is just, like, do these mainframe things, but we can actually sell it to consumers. And then Windows came and kind of shook Apple also a little bit. And Apple was kind of moving in that direction in itself, but Windows was the one which really kind of, or Microsoft was the one which really kind of brought UI or graphic user interface to people. And that, I think, is what really brought somebody like me in that sense. Like, I remember, I'm like, you know, I was born in 86, and my first exposure to computers was maybe, like, mid-90s. And in that sense, like, I'm not somebody, like, who's worked on, like, command line and stuff. And, like, as a 9-10 year old, you're like, hey, you do this and this happens and this happens and that happens. And, like, it's a much more it was much more engaging. I could there were encyclopedias. I think it was Britannica. Like, you can go and read a bunch of stuff. And then the internet happened. Like, you know, the internet completely changed everything. So all of a sudden, any kind of information you wanted was available. You wanted to email somebody who's on the other part of, like, another side of the world, you could do that. I know it's kind of, like, weird, but, like, AOL and Yahoo Chat were, like, amazing. Like, the fact that you could, like, chat with a bunch of strangers on the other side of the world. Then we kind of had, like, Facebook and things like that. But in my opinion, like, that was still part of, like, the internet revolution. Like, it was more like a maturation of what things were before. And it was, like, these things are kind of in waves. We're kind of seeing messaging move back, like social move back to messaging. So, but what really happened was, this is what I was kind of getting to, was, like, we had first the electronics wave, then we had the PC wave. And then after PC wave, we had this internet wave. And after internet wave, the next big wave was mobile, like, where you could actually put it in people's hands. And then after mobile, it seems like that AI is the next thing from a consumer perspective. I mean, obviously, there's the whole cloud thing happening at the back end, which is empowering all of this. And like, you can go into like a bunch of like multiple technology waves, which have enabled all of these consumer waves. But with each of these waves, what we've seen is that the number of consumers who find these things useful or who engage with these things increases, and the amount of time they spend with these things increases. So that's like sort of like where I think AI is like really interesting.
Some of the waves you're talking about, like the internet and the mobile stuff, kind of each of those, at least those two waves themselves, well, I guess all of them really, as each new wave has come in, I think it's fair to say that the wave has brought the technology to a broader set of people. Do you think AI is going to continue to extend the reach of these technologies?
Yeah, I mean, like, think about it, right? Like, most of us, and this is something I always think about, is like, we're very visual people. Like, most of the people in the tech community also are extremely visual people. The amount of screen time we spend is just insane. But there's a lot of people who are doing a bunch of things. Like, if you're cooking, or if, like, for me, it's like cooking or something simple like that. But let's say you are somebody who works with your hands and you need your attention on the car at that point, right? So, and in that sense, like new modalities, like augmented reality, and in that sense, like, I think that's why audio is so powerful. It's the best way to augment reality. Like, people don't think about it that way. People are always like, oh, augmented reality is all about just vision. Like, it has to somehow, like, augment my reality in some sort of visual format. But not really. Like, you know, I'm doing this. I might be working on a certain thing, and I might be like, "Hey Alexa, play music," and then like this thing's gonna pick it up. And I'm not saying it loud enough so that it gets triggered, right? Because I know how loud I need to say it. But the fact is, like, that in itself is augmenting my experience. It's augmenting my interaction with the house in a little way that I don't have to move like in a certain direction. I don't have to sort of lose track of things. So in that sense, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people, like my dad, for example, we've had computers in my house since late 90s. I don't know exactly when. I remember that I made my first computer, like 2001, 2002. But my dad would never touch the computer because he had to work with computers at work, but he would go to work with them at work, come home and never touch the computer. But like when the mobile thing happened, he would still not like play with them. Like, we gave him a smartphone, but he never really used it. But then WhatsApp happened. And then once like WhatsApp happened and all his friends were on WhatsApp, that's when like he was on it. And then the funny thing is, like, he is an extremely political person in the sense that he loves to consume political information and he loves to interact with people. So somebody exposed him to Twitter. And like, so he also now has this tablet, because he doesn't want to do Twitter on his phone. He wants to do Twitter on a tablet because it's like an easier format to read. So there is that, like, you know, and like those tablets are pretty cheap. They're not expensive. And really in that sense, like, you know, think that's why Google, what Google's doing is interesting, because you have to now realize that you can't, and what Snapchat also did is interesting, is that for a lot of these software products, it's not just, the software is not enough. You have to give like a specific hardware which is best suited for that environment. Like, we are using this microphone. We could have just used like a smartphone, right? But like, we're kind of, even though we're hobbyists, like, you know, we're not professionals, but we want to do it in the best way or in an engaging way.
Yeah, so a few things on that. Okay. So first, I guess a little bit of an aside. So you had mentioned that you use kind of like Alexa in your own home, and you think that the audio format of interacting with as the interface is a better thing going forward. But I've heard a lot of criticism, not criticism, but people don't think that AI is going to be as big, or at least Google Assistant isn't going to be as big as Google thinks it is, because social situations, like if you're out, like for me, if I'm in the office, I'm not going to like talk to my Google Assistant and say, "Hey, can you do this for me?" It's because I'm around people.
Yeah.
So there's different situations. There's obviously different situations where it may be more useful and less useful.
Yeah.
So if you're driving yourself around, definitely useful. If you're in home cooking, like you said, definitely useful. But then there are some other social situations where it may not make sense.
I completely agree with that. I think it's exactly what I was kind of getting at as well. It's modalities. And for you, it specifically is that. Let's say right now, I don't want to turn this thing on. I'm kind of scared of saying that because I know it'll trigger it, which is a stupid thing. Like, that's not well designed in that function. And I don't think this is AI, really.
Mm.
Like, this is still like this is a voice interface, but it's not AI backed in the same order as, let's say, I think like a Google can do. And that's why I think, like, because they can be a lot smarter. So there is this. There's also chatbots happening, right? So now, but both of them can be powered by the same engine at the back end.
Like Google Allo or whatever that is?
Yeah, Google Allo or Facebook M, or there's a bunch of chatbots which are like just everywhere right now. And they're all right now, the move is away from if this, then that, right? The move is not that, oh, if he says this, then respond with this. The fact is, like, and again, this is just sort of like maybe like a futuristic dream, is that it understands context. It understands what you're trying to say. And it's not just, hey, do this, or hey, do that. It's more like, let's say I'm trying to learn a language, right? And I'm trying to say that, hey, teach me this. So it kind of understands where I am also. And it'll customize its behavior based on me and based on you. And like, it kind of like gets you in that way. Yeah, I know it's a little futuristic, but I think that's where things are going to go, and things will move in that direction a lot faster, because once you put these things in consumers' hands, the rate at which they evolve is really, really rapid.
Yeah.
And different companies kind of have like different levels of investment on how fast. Like, I think Google Search is just impressive.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there is AI behind that. Like, the knowledge graph thing is just, that's just one modality. But if you can take that and like put it into different modalities. So maybe that's what I'm really saying. What I'm really saying is that we're already seeing some of these, like, again, let's break it down, right? AI is like a genetic term, but there's these like different types of technologies, like decision trees, neural networks, which are out there, which are doing a pretty good job. But still, most of them seem to be stuck in a certain modality, in the modality of the web. They haven't really come out or interacted with the average day-to-day consumer. Like, for me, if I'm having a discussion with somebody, and I remember this, I was actually in China, and we were having this discussion on which community is bigger in the US. Is it Indian Americans or is it Chinese Americans? And I was absolutely certain that it's Chinese Americans. And I instantly, like, you know, pulled up Google and, like, did a search. And again, in China, you have to use a VPN and everything, but, like, and yeah, like, the Chinese American community is bigger, but at the same time, I thought that the Chinese American community was like two or three times bigger than the Indian American community, but it's almost the same size. Like, they're bigger just by like a smudge. So it's that. It's like, and I didn't have to do a comprehensive search for that. I just typed Chinese American USA, and then Google like used knowledge graph and, you know, highlighted the specific population numbers. But that's still something which is stuck in that modality. It's not something which has come to you in like things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's why I'm more excited about the smart device they're putting in than the handphone. And again, I think that's one of the other issues, is that giving it in a mobile interface is maybe not the right case. You use your mobile situation when you are around a lot of people. Like, you use it on a bus, you use it in the office, but in the house kind of setting, it kind of has to be this ambient modality.
That's true. Yeah. So, like, since I'll be getting the Pixel soon, I actually, like I was saying earlier, like, in the office, I probably won't be using kind of the voice commands that much. But I, since I am going on a trip a few weeks after I get the phone, I am hoping that I do find it useful to, like, just kind of have it out and about, and I can, like, talk to it. Like, I'll be with some friends, but it'll be in a traveling context. So it'll make sense for me, like, oh, we need to find something. Let me just ask Google, where is all this stuff at? Like, how do I get from here to there? So I'm looking forward to seeing how that interaction is.
Yeah. I mean, we're already kind of doing that with the device, but you have to go into an app.
Yeah.
So I know I'm being entitled. That's like, oh my God, I have to open an app and then do this, right? Like, that's what I'm really getting to, is like that the app kind of moves in.
Mm.
And that's why I think Amazon Alexa is a great example. And it's at least set that precedent, is that it's changed the app mindset in my head into a skills.
Yeah, what's the function?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, why do I need to open the app? Right? Like, yeah. And I know it's like extremely lazy, but like that's what technology really does. It shaves off like these little milliseconds here and there.
Yeah, well, also beyond just the saving off the time, it's also reducing the amount of thinking you have to do to accomplish a certain task.
Yeah, I would say. True.
Because if you have to like think about the low level things you need to accomplish for that, it saves a lot of mental cycles.
No, I agree. Like that's whenever I go back, right? So whenever I go back to India or if I go to China, not so much because I think they're sort of getting to a point where they're also now a very digital economy. But when I go back to India, I do struggle because you now need to know so much. In the US, you can live a digital life, like right now. Like, you know, your finances can be on Mint. So you have one place to kind of like see all your finances, to manage them. You don't have to go and pay your mortgage anywhere. You can just pay it online. Your paycheck comes into your bank account. You're not really like, you know, going to places. Amazon Fresh will deliver like groceries to your house. In India, that's not the case. Like for all of these little things you have to do, you have to go to an office, right? And now we've moved from these offices to like websites and apps in the US. But in the future, like it ultimately will be at that point. And this is what I told somebody like a year ago. We were in India and this is one of my clients and they were with me and they had never been in Uber, even though they're from the US. Right? Like, but they've never sat in an Uber, but they were in India and they needed to be dropped to the airport. So I got them an Uber and like we were just chatting and they were like, oh, this is actually pretty convenient. Like you just use this app and you get there. And I was like, yeah, it's that simple. But at the same time, like I was like, you know, the best way to explain some of these apps is that they're taking old world luxuries and they're bringing it to the masses. Like getting your laundry done. Somebody pick you up, somebody to cook for you, somebody doing your groceries. These are all like old world luxuries. By the old world, I mean like, you know, in India, like you have people who do these things for you. You don't need to explain to them everything. And that's the skill of those people. That's the value those people serve, that they know a lot of these things. But yeah, like it's really that. It's really like in that sense, allowing you to function on a different level, allowing you to not learn about a lot of these basics. Well, I will qualify this with one thing. Like, I feel lucky in a way, like that I was born in a certain time, that computing was still kind of happening around me, that I got to engage with computers even though I was in India, like when I was like 10 or something. And then I had my first computer, maybe when I was 12 or something. I built my first computer when I was like 13 or 14. And every time like it broke, my dad was like, yeah, I'm not paying to fix it. You fix it. So I had to like actually open it and like learn everything about everything and like fix it. But like the devices we have now, they don't work that way. Like, and I feel bad. Yeah. Like I feel bad in that sense that like the kids who are growing up now in that sense don't get the same exposure as like in a way I got. I know they get their Arduino boards and everything, but like the parent has to be invested in that sense to like teach them all those things. In my case, it was like I was the one who really wanted to like go in and do that. And that's what I think might happen with a lot of people in that sense, that they might start living on this high level, that they don't even think what's happening. Oh, what kind of electronics is powering this? What kind of software is sitting on that electronics, which is powering those things? So it's good and bad.
Yeah, there's definitely been trade-offs with that kind of stuff. With focus on AI, you're talking about how India, even compared to China, it feels like its life over in India is less of a digital life than you kind of see, especially in the US, but also China even has some more digital sides of it. Do you think that there's going to be like a continued divergence between the United States being the driver behind a lot of this AI? Like Google is a US-based company and a lot of their employees are just in Mountain View, really.
Yeah.
And do you think the fact that it's mostly like the same old problems that have existed in tech for a while, like they're just white males that are building all this technology and it's going to be built for them because it's built by them?
Yeah.
Do you think that lack of diversity is going to continue with AI? And do you think that's going to drive some sort of divergence between
them? Yeah. So I think that's like a brilliant question. And there's layers in there. And so let's talk about the history first, right? And before we move into the future. So there's a reason why software became so powerful in the US and why US kind of took a lead. US was traditionally not a high-tech country. And this is, I think, the issue, right? Like, people start thinking, in a certain way, and they think that, oh yeah, US was always high tech.
Not really. Like,
the reason why US had, say, lead in certain technologies was because, A, they did not engage in wars the same way Europe did. In Europe, the economies basically just got demolished because of those big wars. But at the same time, like technologically, those economies were way ahead of the US, for their size at least. And then that allowed US to sort of, you know, leap forward. Some of the best universities were in the US. Those universities were filled with some of the smartest people in the world. Once that happened, all of a sudden, like, you know, when you have a bunch of really smart people working with each other, working on cutting edge solutions, so people like John Von Neumann, brilliant guy, there were issues with his sexuality where he wouldn't be accepted anywhere else. But in the US, people were like, yeah, we don't care. You do your thing in the lab. I mean, it wasn't progressive the same way it is now, but at the same time, it was a don't ask, don't tell policy. Mm-hmm. So it was like, yeah, you're brilliant. Then you keep doing your thing. So a lot of those things really like are not technological as to why things happen in a certain area. Even in like the 70s and 80s, like Japan was catching up. You know, like time had passed and like Japan started catching up. Europe kind of also like was on US's toe. And there were, in my opinion, there's literally two people who are responsible for the US tech revolution. There were Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. I mean, yeah, there's other people like Wozniak and everyone, but like those two kind of became icons. More than Steve Jobs, I give credit to Bill Gates. He literally like single-handedly created this company which was shipping PC software for everyone in the world, right? And if you look at the data from back then, like let's say the late 90s, you will realize that in the US there were competitors for Microsoft in like Windows PC, but outside US there weren't. Like, and in that sense, yes, it was built for the US audience, but Microsoft was always thinking a little more globally than some of the other people. In that sense, like competition is good for a certain economy. And coming back to like where we are right now, so let's now look back at what's happening in India and what's happening in China. So now, at least in software, India's got some pretty good universities. There's a decent economy which is happening. There's AI companies which are present in India, which are getting acquired by US corporations, but the offices are still in India. Even when you think of a Google or a Microsoft, a Google of Microsoft of today is not the Google or Microsoft of 20 years ago. Both of them have Indian CEOs. Yeah. These companies are now much more, they were always multinational, but like in their actual workforce also, they are much more multinational. And in that sense, I think that if they try to create software only for the US, they will not survive. China is a whole different beast. Right, like China's got that great firewall happening. Google just can't go in there. Microsoft is in there. This is something, let's look at the auto industry now, right? So GM's traditionally always been an American business. But then somewhere, you know, I would say 10, 15 years ago, China was like, yeah, you guys can come in and sell cars here. You just have to form a joint venture and teach our local government partners how to make cars. And back then, everyone was like, oh, don't teach them, right? They'll steal your IP and things like that. But personally, this is my opinion. One thing people forget is that government companies are just bad. They're lazy. They have no incentive to innovate. They were like, okay, give us technology. Like they were still never the ones like, you know, who were building amazing tech. There's now private companies in China which are doing amazing work. There's the Huawei's, the Xiaomi's, like, you know, or the DJI, you know, any of these like, technology leading companies, or BYD, and then Baidu also, Tencent, Alibaba, like they're all like private companies. In China, that's going to be like the case. There are these giants which are sitting, which are going to drive technology. But coming back to my point, what I was saying was that GM initially thought of China as a market where they would say that, our technology from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, will ship to China and they'll buy it. But look at them now. Tesla changed the game. I actually see more luxury cars in China than I see in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley people are rich, right? I mean, they pay a lot in rent, so they probably don't have money left to buy cars after that. But there was, I think, 2011 is when GM started selling more cars in China than they sold in the US. GM is an American company, but their customers are primarily in China. And the same thing is true for a lot of high-tech companies also, yeah. Like Qualcomm, Microsoft. they are American companies, but a bigger and bigger portion of their customers are based in India and China. So as that happens, the mindset's going to be like that. Even Tinder, for that example, like I think the first office Tinder opened outside the US was in Delhi, because India was one of their biggest markets. So I think it's not going to be as bad as it used to be in like the 90s or 2000s. But that is definitely something like whoever builds it tends to build it for themselves.
Yeah. So you're saying that, just quickly on the GM point, that more than half of their cars are sold in China?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like they sell more cars in China than they sell in the US. They also sell in Europe and other countries. So like not more than half. But they sell, now I'm guessing they sell much more in China. But 2011 is when that number changed. When China became the biggest market.
Okay. I wonder if their representation of customer base, global population-wise, is at the same proportion. It's probably not, because there's probably Africa is definitely not going to be as large market right now.
Yeah, I mean, like Africa population-wise is also interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Like Africa is a huge continent.
Yeah,
but the population is not that big. Mm-hmm. I think, and I might be wrong, but I think it's like 450 to 480.
Ask Alexa.
Yeah, Alexa, what's the population of Africa?
The population of Africa is about 1,100,000,000.
Wow, see, I was wrong.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say 500,000,000.
Okay.
So it's like, that's a big enough number.
It is a big number, India and China each alone are
1.3
size. Yeah.
They're both 1.3.
Oh, they're both comparable. Okay.
India's going to outpace China. Like in a couple
I've heard that as well.
Yeah. Europe's, I think, 450. Alexa, what's the population of Europe?
The population of Europe is about 739,000,000.
Lots of people now.
Yeah. But see, like that in itself, like defines the scope of things.
Yeah.
Alexa, what's the population of North America?
The population of North America is about 565,000,000.
Yeah. So now you take those numbers.
Yeah.
You know, those rough numbers, like 1.1 billion in like Africa, 700,000,000 or 740,000,000 in Europe. Let's say, Alexa, what's the population of Asia?
The population of Asia is about 3,880,000,000.
So almost 4 billion people in Asia. But then you also have to throw in the disposable incomes.
Exactly, yeah.
So disposable incomes, I'm guessing, in Europe and US are much higher. China's catching up. Mm-hmm. Africa's way behind right now. So which is why even if they have that billion population, software is not going to get made for them for a while. So like in that sense, what you were saying was like, software was traditionally built by Americans for Americans, and it was exported to India, China, or Europe. In that sense, like it might change that now you have Israelis and Chinese and Indians and Europeans and Americans making AI for specifically those countries. But in that sense, then like countries like most of Africa, most of the Middle East, even Russia for that matter, are going to be, for the first 5-10 years, adapting to AI rather than receiving AI that has been built for them. And it's not going to improve their quality of life as quickly.
Well, on that point, actually, so you're saying that, for example, Russia is going to be adapting in the sense that it's going to be like catching up, and AI is being built right now for these larger populations that are using this technology. Technology kind of helps drive social and political change in some sense. Do you think the fact that AI is not really being built for Russians, for example, like possibly not being built for Russians, for example, do you think it's going to drive change in terms of like their political and cultural, social type of things?
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, both of us are unqualified to answer that question, but I'll still take a jab at it because we like to take jabs at things. I think, yes, anytime you have a technological wave, it influences the society in a way like you cannot even imagine. The same thing we saw with the internet, we've seen it in the past. So we are only talking about countries as like monoliths, which is not true. And like that's one thing I wanted to qualify. It's like even in India, right? There's big cities. People living in like big cities in India do live fairly digital lives. They live, like my friends who probably live in Gurgaon, they live just as a digital life as I do. People who are living in Shenzhen, Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, their lives are probably just as digital as most people in New York, Silicon Valley. However, if you are in rural Ohio, your life's probably not as visited as somebody from Chennai. So like, just thinking in countries is not fair. So coming back to the social change happening because of technology, I think, yes, we've already seen that, not just once. We've seen it with the Arab Spring. And this is my opinion. People might find it whatever. But I think what's happening in Europe and also what's happening in the US right now is a result of that. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that with the whole social wave happening, we've started creating bubbles.
Yes.
Like my friends who live in cities just fail to comprehend why anyone would want to support Trump. And I am not trying to defend him, but at the same time, what I'm saying is, have you been to rural America? Their quality of life has not improved in the last few years. But because people in cities in America have gotten out of touch, people in cities in America, which are not that far from them. So the distance, like earlier it was geographical distance, right? It was more like, oh, if you're in Seattle, then you kind of get what Washington's all about. But now, if you're in Seattle, you can live in Seattle, you can fly to Silicon Valley, you can fly to Austin, and those are the only three cities you really care about, right? Like, you're like, oh, yeah, all my people are there. Like, and that becomes your web. And all of a sudden, everything else is just like in between. Same thing in the UK. They actually like did a post-referendum survey, and they realized that most of the people who had voted to leave the European Union were from rural areas. Mm. In my opinion, living in rural area, these are not part of the digital wave, right? Like, that's my thesis is that. But yeah, like, there are people who get left behind. And because they get left behind, somebody else starts communicating with them.
Yeah, it's a challenge of technology in general, right? Because I feel like Zuckerberg, overseeing Facebook, he wants to try and connect people, but I feel like it's not necessarily doing that right now. Because if you look at like Facebook newsfeed, like most people are going to have a very, like you said, like they're in their own bubbles. Like they're not going to see the opposing views because of the way that newsfeed is filtering specifically to their viewpoint. Yeah. So that's like there's AI being applied in there, like. It's all machine learning things being applied there. It's not necessarily helping right now. At least as far as I can tell, it doesn't seem like it's helping.
No, I agree. I think the idea behind like a lot of these social things like Twitter and Facebook was that they were supposed to be the digital town halls. And a town hall has opposing views, right? But at the same time, people were like, the same issues you have with town halls, that people don't want to go to town halls because they don't want to engage in like these kind of discussions, is the same reason people started avoiding. And then Facebook was like, let's just show them what they want to see. Right. And that's the issue with like a consumer product, right?
Yeah.
You are consuming it. Like the goal of Facebook is not to make you a better person. Mm. The goal of Facebook is to make sure that you spend as much time on Facebook. When you spend more time on Facebook, then they can advertise to you. So I don't blame them. But as a result, what we are seeing is this issue that people are living in their bubbles, which is why I think the rise of messaging is a little more interesting to me, because people at least are communicating with like, real people. It's real communication on realer, but like at least you are having real conversation. AI can definitely, and the same thing's going to happen with VR and stuff as well. Like once you consumerize something, it can definitely create like a negative impact. Society.
Do you think AI can also be used to help solve that problem? Like it could be built to be intelligent enough to ensure that you do see a more full picture of what society is going through?
I don't know the answer, honestly. People like you and me are curious people. If somebody gives us an opposing view, like we will engage with them, we will try to sort of fight them at first, but at the same time, if that person is being intelligent, we will at least like discuss it with them. Be like, why are you saying this? Like, what's your, where are you coming from? And like, let me try to understand where you're coming from. With AI, it depends on how you perceive AI. There's the master-slave relationship in the sense that technology can be a master or technology can be a slave. Right now, most of these social apps like Facebook, Twitter, they're like slaves. They are feeding you. And in that sense, as long as they're in that slave relationship, they will never be in a position of authority. Wikipedia, on the other hand, tends to be fairly neutral for multiple reasons. But most people don't go on Wikipedia as much as they go on Facebook. What I'm really trying to get at is, like, if a person is curious, and if the AI is built in a way that it challenges you, it pushes you, it tells you, hey, by the way, you might also want to see this. Like, hey, by the way, this is an opposing view. Or hey, like, it seems like you are posting a lot right-leaning stuff. Here's a left-leaning opinion, and this is what they think. Or like, hey, like, here's like a lot of left-leaning stuff. Like, you're posting a lot of left-leaning stuff. Here's like, and in that sense, like, whenever you're doing any of these things, right, the thing is, you are, in effect, changing public opinion. So are we to say that centrist opinion is right? Right? Like, you don't know. Like, the issue is, like, you don't know what improving is.
Well, I think improving, it'd be fair to say that as long as people get a fuller picture of, like, all sides of things, is probably a better picture than these bubbles that we seem to exist in a lot right now.
Yeah, so I mean, in that sense, like, let's talk about summarization tools, or let's talk about, like, AI-powered journalism. Mm-hmm. And AI-powered journalism, in that sense, is a little interesting, because if there is a bot which can go out everywhere, scrape a bunch of data, and write an article from different sources, and say that, hey, by the way, CNN is saying this, Fox News is saying this, and New York Times is saying this, then you might get a fuller picture.
Is that something that exists today? That sounds interesting.
I think there are tools which do summarization.
Yeah.
And there are bots which do automated reporting of financial data. Because financial data is very easy to report
it's,
on.
It's numbers.
And stuff. Yeah. So, and also like trends. So, like,
yeah.
So, but I don't see it being that difficult in like 5 or 10 years that, you know, as like natural language processing tools improve, that you can have something. I mean, that's how, when I write the newsletter, right, like, that's what I try to do. I try to look at different sources. What I also tend to do is, like, I think YouTube is also interesting in that sense, that YouTube has everything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it has the left-leaning stuff, it has the right-leaning stuff. So, I will actually go in and look at what is the right-leaning public saying.
But on that point, like, yeah, same with me. Like, if I'm watching YouTube a lot, I see it's giving me the same viewpoint of things. Because the things I'm watching, it says, oh, here's more of the same stuff. Because they know it'll engage me more easily. But, I agree. It takes an effort to, like, look at, like, what is the other viewpoint? Like, I want to see that viewpoint, like, because I know it would make me a better person. Like, I know I would naturally give in to, like, watching more of the same stuff I've been watching. But I would like to see more of the new things, like something I haven't seen before. Do you think that's...
I mean, it's exactly, like, the thing is, like, the only analogy I will draw is, like, being on a boat, right? Like, when you're on a boat, the sea has a natural wave, and you can just sit in the boat and relax. But if you want to get somewhere, you have to be the one who has to, like, take charge and point direction. And it's the same thing with, like, these things.
But wouldn't you say that it's... AI would be capable of doing some of that?
I think it would be capable. I think it's capable right now.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Do you think it's their? Do you think it's the tech company's duty to do that, though?
Is it their duty? I think that's a loaded question.
That's right. Yeah. Sure. Sorry.
No, you don't have like.
It's not their duty. But do you think it would be a better moral choice to?
Yeah. I mean,
do that?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, like, I agree. Like, in that sense. These are media companies, right? Like, and there is like that giant ethical standard which old school media companies used to take. Like, a good newspaper was not the newspaper which told you what you wanted to hear. It was a newspaper which gave you like neutral and investigative journalism. And but these companies are calling themselves media companies or social media companies. Well, where is your ethical standard, right? Like,
yeah.
So that question does come in. And, like,
is there a way to make a profitable company that would achieve that particular goal of using AI, Bosphere, or whatever, sharing, like, investigative journalism of the past? Do you think there's a way that AI can bring that back and more both sides of the story?
Ultimately, like, what's happening, and this is maybe just my opinion, AI is created by people, right?
Yeah.
As of now, at least. And it takes a fair amount of investment to create AI. Because it takes a fair amount of investment, most people who are creating AI are either rich or they are raising funding. when you're raising funding, you have to show ROI. And because you have to show ROI, it has to have some sort of commercial role. So because it needs to have some sort of commercial role, that's hard. But there are organizations, if they tomorrow decide that instead of funding, let's say right now most of the philanthropy happens in like doing research for cancer, or let's say finding new technology which can help kids in Africa. But if somebody really like cared about this, and somebody was like, yeah, I'm going to put $20 million or $50 million to create this AI, which is going to do investigative journalism, I think it can do it. I mean, if you are a Wall Street banker and there's software out there to go through the entire annual report of a company like for the past 20, 30 years, then why can't there be a software which does the same thing through like something else, right? Like, I mean, there are tools out there which go through things and give you like some general insights. So I think, yeah, but like in the end, somebody has to fund it. Somebody has to get out and somebody has to be like, yeah, I'm going to fund this thing and it's going to be neutral. And in that sense, probably has to be somebody like Jeff Bezos.
Do you think, it's like on the point of like it needs to find some source of funding or some profitable commercial thing, is there some way we can like look back at the investigative journalism of the past and see if there's any parallels we can look at what worked for them in the past and what can be used to apply?
So, I mean, like, even investigative journalists in the past, right, there wasn't as much competition for attention. There was also a much higher standard, which was like kind of set. Now, if you look at internet sources or internet blogs and stuff, they are recycling content. They're not even creating new content. They're just recycling content because it's cheaper to do that. That's the current state of the media situation right now. I would say that news will have to move away from an advertisement-based model to like a direct payment model. So there is, I think, yeah, the information which is in the Bay Area is this tech investigative journalist. It's just basically like a website. They do investigative journalism on startups, not investigative journalism in the sense of like ethics and stuff, but they bring out like their financials. They will say that, oh, this company is doing an IPO. But if you are like a VC, it's very important information like to be on the cutting. But like again, I'm saying it's a commercial reason that somebody decides to subscribe to them.
So do you think it's maybe niches like that? Like in that example, you're saying it's VCs that are going to pay for this. Maybe in the political realm could be, I don't know who it would be in the political realm. Like who? Because you want to uncover like things like corruption and malpractice of politicians.
Yeah.
And the consumers of that is largely the broader population.
Yeah. Sure, so that's it's a common goods issue.
Yeah. So that's there you go.
Like
yeah.
We ultimately come down to like. And then if the government starts funding something like this, then it becomes basically just like a government body, which is like a vigilance committee or something. But the Census Bureau is technically that. Like the it's not investigative journalism, but like the Census Bureau is like, hey, we're going to provide people information. And this is what's happening in the nation. This is how the demographics are changing. Yeah, like there's the Pew Research Lab. Pew is basically, they do consumer research and market research. But I find them really interesting. They have a lot of insights on like which way things are going. So AI-powered things by the government, I doubt that they will do like deep investigative journalism. But I think they can still uncover a lot of insights about society at any given time, saying that, hey, this is happening, or we are noticing that this particular area isn't really improving as much. Or I mean, honestly, like if they can figure out which policies are working and which policies are not working. Just if there's like better regression or something, right? Like if we can just run better, like better data analysis on things and be like, this policy was shit, but this policy was actually good. And you know, this thing, this school is doing better than any other school in the area. And this is why, like, the good might come in those mechanisms for, I would say, like government reasons. Obviously, there's Palantir, like, which is doing giant AI for the government and doing investigative like stuff, so that already is happening. What should the public be asking their senators, their legislators, that hey, make sure that AI doesn't screw us over by this mechanism. Make sure that the rich people don't use AI to their advantage through this mechanism, or make sure that AI doesn't take over the world.
Yeah. So like on the last point. Elon Musk and also Stephen Hawking and a lot of other really smart people have spoken up in the last couple of years saying that they're afraid of what AI can become capable of. And this is much broader than just like, oh, is it inequality or whatever. They think it's an existential threat where AI could truly become powerful enough and kind of advanced enough where it could lead to essentially the demise and the end of human society, like all human races kind of disappear through various mechanisms of like one trivial example that has been talked about. There could be somebody that has this brilliant AI that has perfect understanding of the world and perfect like kind of interaction with the physical world, and it's given a specific goal to like just make as many stamps as possible. So it'll just go through, like, you'll buy all the stamps around the world, it'll, like, on eBay and everything, that it'll take over, like, hack into, like, factories everywhere and rejigger them to become stamp-making factories. And just, like, through all that type of thing, it'll continue to use up all the resources specifically for the goal. So that's kind of a silly example, but that's the kind of idea.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, it's the classic problem, right? Like, when an obsession takes over, but obsessions have also taken over humans.
Exactly.
And there have been great conquerors who were like, I want to take over the world, or like, I just want to be like the richest man alive or something, right?
Yeah, so, and the fear of AI is like, it can obviously run to that same obsession type thing, but then it would have potential to have control over like all the fact that we're living this digital life now. AI could take over all that and just kind of hack it through all that and control essentially everything in the world.
So in that sense, there. Like, maybe the issue is that we are assuming that the AI is all sentient, and
it doesn't have to be sentient for that to happen.
I mean, that it knows all, that it can hack into any system it wants.
Yeah, that's probably a strong assumption, so it's not. Yeah, that looks okay. A bit fair. But going back to the point of what can people ask their legislators, any new area of technology, if you regulate too soon, you're going to stifle the innovation. And my personal opinion right now is that AI is still very early on, that I'm not sure if it makes sense to really push any regulations out. But then once it gets to a stage where, I don't know where the defining line would be where regulation would make sense, but once it gets to a point where it needs it, then I think the regulation that needs to exist would be something like ensuring it, essentially the equality aspect of it, like making sure that it doesn't disproportionately help certain areas of the population versus others. But
do you think we need like an AI defense? Like the same way like we have nukes for defensive purposes, right? Like, do we need to create a super AI which we just keep in reserve? Which we don't even use, but we just keep it just in case one of those OCD AIs gets out.
But the thing with AI is that since it is just essentially a computer program running, if you have one super AI, then you can just make copies of it. And it obviously has the training phase, it needs to learn what it needs to do. But
the goals are different.
Yeah, that's a fair point. You could have a defense AI in the sense that you have the same super AI program, but you trained one of them to be purely focused on defending from potential threats from any other AI. So that may actually be something that's worthwhile to go after. And that'd be something that the legislators could help drive, like ensure that we have some sort of defending AI that protects us from other threats.
So as of now, are you more scared or excited about AI?
Definitely more excited. I understand Elon Musk's point about it being a potential existential threat, but right now I think we should still continue to, like, he's continuing to invest in it and make sure he's got open AI to build out the best AI that's possible, make sure it's open source, everybody has access to it. And I think that's a great thing for them to be doing. But then, in general, I'm just more excited about the technology. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm way more excited than I'm scared. Honestly, I think I'll be dead before the existential threat comes in anyway. So, yeah, I'm, like, excited. I think it's going to improve lives a lot. I think there's going to be competing AIs. Mm-hmm. And the same way we have competing people right now, and with different viewpoints. And but I am scared a little bit of the social implications of AI and how it will sort of, you know, maybe empower inequality or maybe empower social